Welcome to episode 68 of the Payers and Players podcast. My name's Robert. I'm here with Scott, and we're also here with a special guest here for a third time. Scott, why don't you introduce our special guest?
Yeah, so if you're familiar with the podcast, I'm sure that you know the name TJ Pura. TJ was on episodes 11 and 50, and so we're excited to have him back on episode 68 and find out what he's been up to and where he's gone. We talked to him a couple years ago. At that point, he was in New York working in finance. So TJ, why don't you give us an update on what you've been doing the last couple of years?
Yeah, absolutely. Robert, Scott, always good to be on with you guys, and been great to follow the content. I can't believe it's episode 68. You know, I remember our first conversation. I remember our first conversation so well, talking about junior development. And I think one of the boys was injured at the time, but it's just amazing to see him grow over the last really 4 years. And to see your guys' community grow as well. So at the top, congrats.
Thanks.
And love what you guys are doing.
Appreciate it.
So yeah, I guess to catch you guys up on what I've been last time we spoke, it was about 10 o'clock in New York City. That's and right. I was still in the office.
10 p.m. That would be 10 p.m.
Yeah, 10 p.m. had another few hours to go. So I was in investment banking back then at a company called Jefferies in New York City. It was my first, real desk job after finishing playing tennis. And a serious challenge, just from a kind of mental toughness perspective, things that we touched upon back then. But for me, that was always a stepping stone to doing something in social impact, which is an area that I've been very passionate about since my early college years. I started a nonprofit organization called Food Recovery Network at Duke, and knew that after tennis, once I was in the professional world, I didn't just want to, quote unquote, have a good job. I wanted to really have a job that was making an impact. So I leveraged my knowledge of renewables and power systems from being a power utilities and infrastructure investment banker to work for SunPower, which is one of the two largest residential renewable energy companies in the United States. And I worked for their finance, capital markets, M&A team. So do a lot of, you know, business development type initiatives and capital markets activities. So just getting money from people and structuring those kinds of deals. So it's been great to leverage my banking experience. You can call that the training. And now it's like I get to play the match, you know, for SunPower and do some good. So that, I guess, from a location perspective too, we definitely spoke pre-COVID. Once COVID hit, I actually moved down to North Carolina with my serious partner, Maddie Price, who was an Olympian. Actually, I got to give her a quick shout out. She was in the Tokyo 2020 Olympics, competed for Canada, came in fourth place. So incredible that they did that well, but also a little tough, you know, being one out of the medal. But we were in North Carolina for about a year and a half of COVID. And then she was finishing up her kind of career with her first coach she's had for 10 years. And meanwhile, I was looking for a new job, and we settled on Austin, Texas as a great spot for her to train and me to work at SunPower. And it's been amazing. It's us two and our dog, Brooklyn. Digging it. Austin's a great place.
Okay. So on your social media, I see that you're retrofitting a van too. What's that all about?
Yes, sir. Yeah. The van build. So we went in about September, went up to Colorado for a little vacation, and I caught like the mountain biking, downhill, kind of like extreme sports bug. As extreme as like a pure amateur can get, but you guys know me, I'm pretty intense. So I like to keep it on the knife's edge if I can, but, did like downhill mountain biking. I also hadn't skied since I started playing tennis seriously, but really liked skiing as a kid. And I was up there, and it's first of all, beautiful. And I love being out in nature and on the open road. And then there were all these camper vans that were like all fitted out. And I never really paid much attention to the camper vans before. And I was like, Maddie, these seem really cool. Like, we should think about maybe getting one. And my mind goes pretty quick. So that was maybe on a Tuesday. By Wednesday, I was like, all right, babe, you know, there's one in Utah. We can go and drive, pick up, you know, tomorrow. And she was like, slow your roll. Like, we're not going to buy it tomorrow. So we ended up getting like a base cargo van a RAM ProMaster, and we're just building it out from the complete ground up, which has been a good experience. I definitely wouldn't call myself the handiest guy in the world up until about a month or two ago. And I certainly wouldn't call myself that now, but I am a lot handier now than I was a couple months ago. So it was kind of like, one, I think the final product is going to give us a lot of freedom. And I love driving, love the idea that you could just stop off, sleep in your van, not worry about it. But also I saw it as a way to really improve upon something that for me was like a hole in my game, a weakness, if you will, which is like, you know, putting stuff together and being thoughtful around things that you're doing with your hands. So kind of a combination of both, but it's been a very rewarding experience. We just installed all of our windows. We did 5 windows, and you do all those by hand, you know, cut a hole in the side with a jigsaw and, mm-hmm. you know, and then actually put the windows up. So long story short, it's been fun, and, you know, I'm starting to get a little bit better.
Yeah, Scott. So
that's awesome.
You're going to have to tell them about what you've got going with the YouTube channel that was started
my stepdaughter.
That's right. And then also, TJ, you need to follow, I don't know if you found Rich Rebuilds on YouTube. But
I'm going to follow him right after this.
Well, what he did is he started out as a guy who bought junked Tesla vehicles and he would rebuild them. And he got a big YouTube channel going. But then after that, he did some retrofit vans and really, really built them out nice. So entertaining YouTube channel. But Scott, why don't you tell about your stepdaughter?
Yeah. So my stepdaughter and her husband, they did the same thing. You know, they went out and got a Sprinter van, retrofitted it with beds, showers, and, you know, bathroom and everything. And now they're just traveling around the country, you know, exploring the country and, you know, trying to put up some content on YouTube and all that stuff. So it's a lot of fun. There's a whole community out there that's doing that. And it looks like it's a lot of fun. And like I say, you know, I think you got the right idea. When you go out there, you sort of get that bug for, you know, the biking and the skiing, and then you just want to have the flexibility to go out there and do it. And if you have something that can get you there, then that's all you need.
Right.
Exactly. And one of the things about TJ that he mentioned, you can tell this is how he is. When he gets into something, it's like, there's no, I'll wait a little while. Yeah. I'll take a minute to research it. No, it's like, we going, we're full speed.
Exactly. Exactly. Like pedal to the metal.
I like
pedal to the metal. Well, obviously at some point too, I would love to talk about my boy, Tommy Paul. His most recent results.
I was actually going to ask you about that.
So yeah.
And I was going to say, Scott will never pass up an opportunity to talk some Tommy Paul. So that's a good thing. I like it.
Hey,
there we go. But yeah, no, I mean, like when we talked 2 years ago, you know, he had just broken into the top 100, you know, you'd been working with him, and, you know, now 2 years later, he's number, I think, 43, just won his ATP title in Stockholm beating Chapo. So yeah, talk about that.
I mean, it's been truly like one of the most rewarding journeys to, one, participate in firsthand, but especially over the last couple of years to kind of observe. I wouldn't say from afar because we stay in touch, but watching him on TV on the biggest stages, it's been so rewarding to see how much he's grown. You know, a couple of things that stand out to me is just his level of focus and determination and commitment to the game. Like, if it was a 7 out of 10, you know, a year ago, 2 years ago, now it's a 9.9 out of 10. Like, that guy just wants to go out, compete, win. He doesn't mind spending 8 weeks on the road and making the sacrifices that I think were a little bit challenging for him to make at a younger age. And now he's full on, fully committed. And, you know, his tennis has changed a little bit. Like, he's definitely coming forward more, being more aggressive. That's helped him a ton. But if you, I don't know how much you watched of Stockholm or even Indian Wells, but mentally, I mean, nothing phases that kid on the court now. And, you know, no one would have said that about Tommy Paul 2 years ago, but now he's a cool, calm customer. Right. And I think that's really something that's helped his tennis lately.
Yeah. What do you think the change was there?
You know, I think time, honestly, it's like to a degree, like we all, learn from our past. So I think that's number one. And then also, I think he's made a really conscious decision to look at the ways in which here's what's controllable. Here are ways in which I can gain an edge. Like if I'm playing Rublev, okay, maybe Rublev has a better forehand, but I'm going to stay mentally tougher than him. And maybe that washes out Rublev's forehand. You know, if he stays over 2.5-3 hours, he's cool, calm, collected, while Rublev is up and down. It doesn't matter how good someone's forehand is. You know, I mean, obviously you still need to play, but I think those sorts of, that sort of approach in him, you know, working really hard on his fitness and saying, hey, why can't I be the fittest or one of the quickest guys out there? And he's like on the track when he's in Miami 2-3 times a week running 200s and 400s. So I just see that commitment spilling over to a lot of the controllable aspects, which, I mean, I feel like we've talked about in the past. You can only judge yourself on what you can control, and you can only hold yourself to that standard. Because otherwise it would be an unfair comparison to put on yourself to say, hey, I need to play well today. Like that's a lot. But if you go in, you say, I need to move my feet today. I need to have a good attitude today. I need to fight my butt off today. And hopefully I play well, you know, like that's very different than putting pressure on yourself to play well, which is, I think, something he might've done in the past, which is completely reasonable to do. And we all do it, but I think he's really digging in on the things where, hey, this is where I can get a 1% edge on the top five guys. And, you know, he's putting himself in there, and the results are speaking for themselves.
That's right. You know, I did watch the final when he played Shapovalov in Stockholm. And, you know, one of the things that came down to the third set, there was this one break in the third, and that break happened when Shapo sort of lost his composure because there was some noise in the crowd or something. He let that bother him. Tommy wasn't affected at all. And one break is all you need. And he was able to, you know, get the break, serve it out with, you know, with that great match point. And, you know, it was like, here's a guy that's, like you say, you know, who's on the rise, who's coming up from, you know, 100. Chapo's been there for a few years, made the semifinals of Wimbledon, you know, the more established player, the defending champion in Stockholm, I believe. All the pressure was on him, and he let the moment break him down, whereas Tommy just stayed even, and he just rode it out. So that was what I noticed as well.
Yeah. No, I completely agree. And if I could add one thing too. Yeah, sorry, Robert, go ahead.
No, go ahead. Add one thing. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I feel like another piece is that Tommy's taken the long view in terms of, you know, this is the player that I want to be in 2-3 years, not, you know, where I want to be right now. And I remember looking at y'all's Instagram and seeing that interview you did with Zverev, that I think it was a Western and Southern, but how he talked about he didn't have much success in the juniors until he was 16, 17, 18, because he was building a game for the future. And I feel like Tommy's done that in the pros, especially recently, where he's, you know, working on coming in and putting pressure on his opponents. And hey, he got passed a lot and didn't win, was winning, you know, 50% of his net points for 6, 12, 18 months. And now all of a sudden he keeps doing it, keeps doing it, keeps doing it. Now he's like 85, 90% at the net. And he's just a force up there because he's not willing to say, okay, you know what? Maybe I lose a match today by coming in. Maybe I lose a match tomorrow by coming in. But a year, 2-3 years down the road, I'm going to be like Pat Rafter up there. Yeah. And I think that is the mindset you need to commit to if you are going to reach, you know, the top of your potential.
Yeah, I think the thing that I've noticed as I've watched pro tennis in the last couple of years is a few players that have done that exact thing. You think about Tennis Sengren, and there are a lot of folks who would say, hey, at 20, at 22, you know, you ought to give up because look, there's these young guns who are coming up, up and comers who are breaking in quicker. And I always go back to that, almost that Tom Brady type mentality. Like, I mean, a couple of his Super Bowl seasons that they won the Super Bowl, they started the year 0-2. And you just think about, okay, we're just going to keep, as Greg Schiano used to say at Rutgers, we're just going to keep chopping wood. If I just sit here and I just keep chopping wood on this giant tree, eventually I'm going to cut it down. You know, it may take a long time, but I'm just going to keep chopping wood. And I think there's a bit of a mentality. How do you think these players, the two things that I wonder for players that are doing that is first, how do they not get discouraged? And second, how do they afford it? Because when you're going all over and traveling everywhere and entering and flying and doing all those things, how do they end up being able to hang in there like they have?
Sure. The first answer, I think, how do you not get discouraged? You know, tennis players have a lot of practice with being discouraged and dealing with how to overcome that. And it happens right the first time you step on and play your first match as a junior, all throughout your junior career. And then it goes into college and then it goes into pros. But, you know, you can't expect yourself never to get discouraged. But I think just every day that goes by, every match that you play, you build up the ability to be more and more resilient and take the long view. And if you lose today, that's okay. As long as you know that the game you're playing is preparing you to win tomorrow, next week, next month, next year. So I think, you know, you can't get discouraged. You can't let yourself get discouraged with results if you want to reach your full potential. And Robert, your second question, can you remind me your second question?
How do they afford it? I mean, to not break out to your say 27 and you fly here and go there and we look at there's futures and challengers all over the world, Egypt, and people are going, how do they hang in there until they can finally work it out? Because some people mature differently. Some people mature mentally differently, right, physically differently. And like what you were saying, some of Tommy's improvement wasn't a physical improvement. Some of it was being, you know, but a lot of it was just mental, being able to just hang in there and understand that it's going to be hard and not let those things bother me. And so what are your thoughts on how they find a way to ultimately be able to, because part of staying there long enough to develop is just having enough money to stay in there long enough to develop. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, it's a great point. Like there, it takes money to stay in the game. But if I were to take a step back and say, okay, what's going to allow you to have the money to stay in the game? The two kind of values that I feel like every tennis player that sticks around for a while has is one, belief. Like maybe I'm 350 in the world now, but I know I can get to top 50. I know I have that in me. I believe it fully. Right. And they believe it. The most successful players, they believe it more than anyone else. Everyone else could say, hey, you're crazy. You're not going to make top 100. As long as that player says, no, I know I'm going to make top 100. And this is why, that's what matters. Number two, I think, is commitment. If you're not committed to say, okay, hey, things maybe aren't going my way right now, but they will, you know, as long as I stick to it, keep chopping wood, as you're saying, then I think that opens up the door for these guys get really creative with funding their careers. And then they go out and they find sponsors, or they go and they're, you know, trading equities or cryptocurrencies to cover flights and, you know, teaching tennis when they're at home and getting some extra cash. Like they're really scrappy and trying to find ways to make money when you're at the, you know, 200 to 600, 700, 800 in the world level. But as long as you have belief and commitment, like I think people find creative ways to fund their career and find people. Like the last thing I'll say too, is that belief is contagious. You know, if you believe in yourself and you explain it to someone why you believe in yourself and you show them your belief and where it comes from, well then, hey, maybe you might have someone that says, hey, Robert, I believe in you now too, man. Like, you know what? I'm a, you know, tennis center, and I think he might've gone to Tennessee or Ole Miss, but maybe he finds an Ole Miss donor who says, hey, tennis, you know what? 50 grand this year, man, let's freaking do it. But it all starts with the belief and commitment.
Yeah. And Robert, I think that it's funny that you mentioned that particular example, but I think that tennis did have something similar like that happen to him, where somebody that had been, you know, seen him as a junior offered to help out with him financially for a couple of years and said that, you know, I believe in you. I know you've got what it takes, but you don't have the tools that it takes. So here are the tools, now go do it. And I think that that's how he was able to, at 25 or whatever, to go from, you know, a guy who was, you know, struggling in the challengers to break out of that and to make a, you know, he's been, you know, quarterfinals of the Australian Open twice, you know, he's had a great career since. And so, you know, I think it's that sort of random thing, or that sort of, but you've got to show that you have that in you for someone else to believe in you.
Right.
Right.
Well, it's an interesting sport that's being played where you think about each NFL football team has somewhere in the range of 52 players times 32 teams. There's so many players on the NFL roster that are making a good living. Same with baseball and a lot of the team sports. But in tennis, it's such a small number of people who are truly making a breakthrough living. That's why, to me, the not giving up and the continuing to compete is even more impressive, because they're not just having to do it on the court. They're having to find a way to continue to compete financially as well. I know that there's a movie coming out about Kurt Warner, kind of the same story, right, as he moves through the Arena Football League after bagging groceries at a grocery store and finally gets his opportunity. Just that desire to never give up is impressive.
Yeah, and on that, you know, I think we've probably all seen the Richard Williams movie by now too, but also, you know, that's a story of a guy that believed in what he was doing, even though everyone thought he was crazy. He knew he had this plan and he stuck to it. So that's a great movie if anyone hasn't seen it yet.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, I actually just watched it on – that was my Sunday night movie. Yeah. It was really good.
Any other takeaways from you on that?
No, I mean, I thought I just love it. Like, it's funny. Richard Williams reminded me a lot of my dad. and, you know, at a young age as a kid, you don't know what you're doing. You know, and I feel like we've talked about this. It's the parents' mm-hmm. job to kind of guide the kid when you're 10, 11, 12, 13, 14. And I thought Richard, you know, I didn't know how well-rounded he kept the girls, that he would pull them out to go to a violin lesson or to go to church, and that tennis wasn't the only thing. But having watched the movie, it made a lot of sense in terms of how the girls are now, seeing how he raised them and the values that he instilled. And like, yes, he was hard on them, but like you said in the movie, he kept them off the streets. And he believed in them more than anything. So I think it was, you know, it was a little bit emotional to watch for sure. In the best way, because it gave me an appreciation for how my dad treated me as a kid. And like the values that he instilled in me when I was a junior. And it, you know, was just really cool to see his belief pay off, you know, continually, no matter how stubborn he was. But, you know, he was the man with a plan. And, you know, credit to the girls. It's like, you can lead the horse to the water, but you can't make him drink. Like, he also made sure that when they went out, it wasn't, hey, you got to go win. It was just go have fun, you know? Yeah. And I think that is so important. It's like, you want your kid to believe that they can be the best and expect the best out of themselves. But once they go on in the court, you're not like looking for that result. You're just looking for them to have fun, you know, and whatever happens, happens. But if you're putting pressure on the result, then that's where things are going to go a little bit
haywire. 100%. I always say attitude and effort. The only two things you can control are attitude and effort, right? Walk out there and compete no matter what's happening. And don't act like an idiot. Attitude and effort. and good Robert, things tend to happen, right? But that's what you can control. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say it's so funny you say that. Back when I was in Jefferies in investment banking, in the summers, the interns come in, you know, these young, hungry college kids who are basically doing their first ever desk job, and they get work to the bone. They work, you know, 80 to 100 hour weeks as interns minimum. And they would come up to me as a full-time and say, hey, TJ, like, what do I need to do? What do I need to do? How do I be a good investment banker? And I would tell them, being a good banker is about two things, effort and attitude. And, you know, I think being successful in life, and no matter whether it's a van build, a podcast, a YouTube channel, effort and attitude, you give 100% effort and you have a good attitude, good things are going to happen. And even if everything goes against you, nothing works out, as long as you knew that you gave 100% effort and you had a good attitude, you can't be mad at the result. It would make no sense to do that, because you tried your best and you know deep down what your best looks like. And if you can look in the mirror and say, yeah, I gave it my all, no matter what the result is, you got to be okay with the result.
Well, and every time I would compete, whether I was a player or a coach, I would always think to myself, did I do the very best I could? And if the answer is yes, and you still lost, then you just got to tip your hat to the other guy and move on, you know, the other team and move on. Because it ultimately, all you can do is what you can do. I think where people mess up is just like you said, you're trying to control the outcome and you get to worried about things that you can't control and you're just wasting energy. Ultimately, attitude, I mean, that's all you can control. So you might as well work on those things and let the chips fall where they may.
So TJ, I'm going to flip it to you guys. Having said that, what are some of the, as a tennis parent with the kids now being, you know, 13, 14, what are some of the current challenges that y'all are facing? Or not necessarily, they could be challenges, but also some of like the key areas of focus that you're looking to develop with the boys, you know, as people or off the court or from a mentality perspective, less so, you know, forehands and backhands and serves.
Well, I'm happy you mentioned that, because I was about to ask you something similar. I think the struggle right now, and one of the things I've been really intentional on, is passing off the tennis, all the tennis that I can onto Everett. So now he's booking all the tournaments. He's got the app on his phone. He does all that with his coach. He books all his practices. I told him, I said, my role now is just money and transportation. I get you there and I'll pay for it. Outside of that, this is your thing. And it really, I think, has helped, because now he's driving it. He's deciding what day he trains. He's deciding what tournaments he plays in. And I think over time, that's going to be beneficial. I think the main challenge now is making a decision at 13. Do you, because he plays soccer, he does other things in regular school still, do you do the academy thing? Because I do see a benefit to an environment where he's got other players with the same goals around him, all of them, you know, influencing one another, and then also the benefits of the training being consistent. And so I wondered your thoughts. You know, I know that you mentioned you never did go to an academy, did you?
Full time? No, I did not.
So what I was going to ask you is, we've asked you this before, but would you do it different? Would you keep doing what you were doing? Because the thing is, you know how tennis is, there's periodic injuries here and there, little things where you're off 2 weeks or whatever. And I love watching him compete in other sports. And so I think we're at a bit of a crossroads. Scott, do you agree?
No, absolutely. Everything you said sounds exactly right. Yeah.
And then you talk about, okay, so if we do go, do we do the homeschool thing? Do we do the virtual school thing? So I think what a lot of parents are going through we've kind of come to that spot in the journey. And so you're having to make decisions that you really don't know what the right answer is. And you're just kind of figuring out as you go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, first of all, tipping my cap to you, Robert, as a dad, to have that sort of to take that approach with Everett and to give him the opportunity to have that level of ownership over his tennis career at such a young age, I think is astounding. And it's not only gonna, like, this is his first time taking ownership of something really important. And I think it'll just lay the path for anything that he chooses to do in the future, having that ownership. And I think is going to make him extremely successful in whatever he chooses to do down the line. So I commend you on that. You know, to the point about whether or not to go to an academy, I hate to say it, but it's such a personal, right. It's such a personal decision. Everyone is different. You know, if he loves going to school and he loves hanging out with his buds and, you know, he doesn't mind the fact that he doesn't practice, you know, twice a day, and that he's not in a virtual classroom, and that everything's not all tennis all the time. And that's something that he actually enjoys and maybe even gives him some more energy to put into tennis. Well, then maybe homeschooling isn't the best fit. But if Everett's saying, hey, dad, you know what? I don't want to do soccer practice. I want just tennis all the time. And I know that it may mean that I'm putting more hours on the court and maybe there's a higher risk for burnout, but dad, I love tennis. I just want to play all the time. I want to be around the best players that I can be. And, you know, then go for it. And also recognize that it's not a permanent decision. You know, he could go to an academy and put him in and see how it goes for 3-6 months. And if it's a fit, great, keep going. If it's not, hey, come on back home, you know? So, and I think it's also, we're always taking risks and things where we don't know what the future looks like, but we make a decision because that's where, you know, we feel like our heart lies. And then you learn something from making that decision. You go through, hey, yeah, you know what? That was a great fit. Let's keep doing it. Or, hey, you know what? Wasn't exactly what I had in mind. I actually missed some things about being in full-time school and, you know, I want to go back, and both ways are totally fine.
Well, I think you nailed it. The discussion we've had, and he's on the boat. I want to go, please let me go. Right. And so I'm trying to protect the burnout, just like you said. And, but I think what the main thing that you've said that I keep reminding he and my wife is it's not permanent. If you go for 6 months, you hate it. You go for a year, you hate it. We can always come back to what we're doing right now. So I think that's a really good call out, but it's still difficult. You know, it's still a difficult decision because he's all in thinking, understanding the world from a 13-year-old brain. He doesn't understand the full impact that at 25, chances are he's not playing tennis professionally. And so, you know, do you sell out and do this? But I think that, you know, just like you said, there's negatives and positives. It's not permanent, but I do think the big thing is what are his desires? Scott, what are your thoughts?
No, I think that's right. You know, what you said about, you know, having him have to drive the boat and all that stuff. But, you know, the other thing is that I struggle with my son is, you know, when he's in regular school, the kids that he hangs around with aren't encouraging of tennis. You know, they make fun of tennis. And so when he goes to an academy, he's around like-minded kids and his desire for the game is a lot higher. He's more motivated. So the struggle we have when we're in regular school is just his passion for the game seems to, you know, come and go. On the weekends when he's at tournaments, he's super passionate. He loves being there. But when he's back in, you know, say regular school, it's a little bit different story. So that's the struggle that we're working with right now.
Yeah. I think that's every kid's a little bit different. But, and that, isn't it funny? You end up being in a situation where you truly, and that's what's so interesting about this podcast, I think, and asking all these folks and what's interesting about everybody we've interviewed is everybody has gone back and forth on a different perspective. Everyone took a different route. So many pathways to that success. But I guarantee you the internal struggle we're having, parents all throughout the tennis world are going through the exact same thing. And that's one thing I liked about the Richard Williams movie is he was very convicted, or at least Will Smith seemed to be, about the decisions that he was making. And I think that he knew what he had. And that was one thing, you know, we've played a lot fewer tournaments. And one of the reasons I've told Everett, you know, there's not these folks that are playing 40 tournaments in a 52-week year, whether you, it doesn't leave any room for development. But so I think that when you watch him reduce the number of tournaments in that movie and just train and improve, that was an interesting decision that a lot of people said he was crazy to do and end up working out. But then you may have another player that makes the exact same decision. It doesn't work out. So there's no cookie cutter. Everybody's got to kind of work through their own pathway.
That's right.
Everyone's different. Yeah. I mean, I follow golf a lot and, you know, I don't know how much y'all know different players, but every player has a different kind of story to what made them successful. Colin Morikawa, who's number two in the world. He's basically the fastest to getting a couple majors behind Tiger. But he went out and he like never spent any time as a junior on the range, which would basically be analogous to a tennis player going out and never doing drills, just like learning through playing points and playing sets. And that's what he did. He said, hey, that's how I figured out how to hit my shots. Meanwhile, you have other guys who, like, you know, Justin Thomas or Xander Schauffele or Phil Mickelson, who they spend all day on the range and they need to rep things out, you know, not on the course, and then take that out and then hopefully transfer it. And, you know, they're all top five in the world, all immensely successful, but they've gone about it in different ways.
Yeah.
I think it kind of goes back to, you know, our belief and commitment. If you believe in your process and you believe in your path that you've created for yourself, then, and you're committed to it, well, then keep going down, like keep doing that. You know, if there's doubt that creeps in and you're saying, hey, you know what, this is what I think could be improved, or hey, maybe we should change this, trust that, because that's only going to make you be even more committed and have more belief in what you're doing. So yeah, it's like, there's no cookie cutter answer. Everyone does something different, but I think it's, you know, you can't understand what to do without experimenting a little bit and taking risks. And, you know, ultimately you'll learn from them and understand. Robert, to your point, nothing's permanent. You know, you can always go back. That being said, you know, I feel like there are certain things that you want to keep in the back of your mind, which I don't need to preach to you as parents, because you're keeping it probably chiefly in the back of your mind. But things like being well-rounded, being as well-educated as possible, certain things in which if you go straight homeschool to a cookie cutter tennis academy, it's going to be difficult to pair all those things. But if you're intentional about, okay, I want my kid to be in academy and get a great education, where are the locations in which he could do both? You know, what are the standout programs or academies where it's a top online school, where he's in the online school that Harvard accepts, you know? So there's, you're not sacrificing in that regard. And it's hopefully just upside.
So changing the subject, or go ahead, Scott.
No, I was just kind of, it's interesting that you mentioned Harvard. Our last guest, Cooper Williams, he just signed with Harvard last week, and he's been doing, you know, one of the good online schools. So you're right. You know, you can still go to Harvard, you can still go to online school and train full time and still go to Harvard.
Yeah. Is he Laurel Springs?
Absolutely.
Guy? No, he was the Dwight School.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, that's right. That was that online synchronous kind of private school in New York, I think he said. That was interesting. TJ, changing the subject, you're right now in Austin. Is your family still in the Northeast?
Yeah, most of my family's in the Northeast. My mom, my two brothers, and my sister.
So for the holidays, you headed up there?
Yeah, I'm actually flying out to New York tomorrow morning. To be with the family. Thanksgiving's my favorite holiday. So
yeah.
Awesome. Very excited.
That's awesome.
Hey, and also tell us about what you're doing with the International Tennis Hall of Fame. There's some sort of committee on.
Yeah. So Todd Martin, as president of the International Tennis Hall of Fame, basically created a task force called the Emerging Leaders Council. And the idea is to grow the sport of tennis out to sort of younger generations, given that the Tennis Hall of Fame has historically catered to an older demographic. So it's about 10 to 12 ex-college tennis players. I think I'm the youngest probably by a couple years, but our goal is to increase awareness around the Hall of Fame, its events, its players, and really grow the sport of tennis. So we're actually doing our first virtual event, which is a podcast, which is a wine tasting fireside chat with Andy Roddick, which, you know, obviously you're not, wine tasting is an option, but you can also just buy a ticket to attend the event. But that's our first kickoff event, which we're really excited about. You know, and I appreciate that you guys have shared across your channels, but that'll be December 8th. So I'm definitely going to put a plug in for that event. I think it's going to be really cool. Andy's an exciting guy. It'll be wine tasting. It'll be tennis. Should be pretty, pretty sweet.
So, and how do people sign up for that? Where do they find it? Where do they find more information on that?
Yeah. So there's a link through tennisfame.com. I think it's tennisfame.com/chatwithandy, and you can purchase your tickets online. There's three options. One is there's two wine tasting options where you get four wines, then you get three wines, and then there's an option to just attend the Zoom event. And that's a $35 ticket. Okay, so
that's cool.
I can shoot you guys the link after this.
Yeah.
Good. Yeah. We'll definitely post it in the show notes and when we tweet it out. But I guess I'm not very sophisticated, but how does a virtual wine tasting go? Do they mail you the wines or do you have to go pick them up? How does it work?
Yeah. Good question. So they mail you the wines in advance. So we partnered up with a winery called Voluptuary. And we basically get our attendees, send them the list of attendees and addresses and the wine orders, and then they ship it out. It arrives well before the 8th, and then you kind of open up your kit and you go through the tasting with everyone else that's on the call.
Well, that's pretty fun. Cool.
Yeah, that's
really cool. So that sounds like something that, Scott, we need to get our wives involved in. They may enjoy that.
I'm sure. Yeah, maybe not, but yes, absolutely.
Well, TJ, every time we have you on, it's great. Yeah. I think that you're super engaging and always real reflective. And I've never had a conversation with you, even offline, that I didn't enjoy. So we always appreciate you coming on.
Robert, that means a lot. I mean, the feeling is more than mutual. I couldn't respect or admire what y'all are doing any more than you currently are that I currently do. It's just a pleasure to talk to you. You guys are so thoughtful, and you know, I really think you're just doing an amazing thing for the tennis community.
Well, appreciate that.
All right. Well, until next time, episode 4, yeah, or episode 3 with TJ down. It sounds like in a couple of years, we'll be on episode 250 and about our 5th time with TJ. So that'd be great.
There we go. My only request is to be on episode 50,000.
That's right. We need to just start. Yeah, that'd be a good one. I like that. I like where you went with that.
7 episodes. Yeah.
So you know, the funny thing is we just need to start calling TJ an honorary co-host because we've had so many episodes with him.
Right. And he's starting to ask us questions now. So it's we're getting the treatment.
Well, so, anytime, you know, it's an honor to be on with you guys. You know, anytime you want to chat, let me know. If you have any questions, anything you want to talk about, always love talking with you guys. All right.